Cacophony showed up at one of mine, and they all showed up as waiters with black eyes. And then they all showed up, and they threw dinner rolls at each other throughout this event in Berkeley at the old, what was the bookstore on Telegraph? Cody's. Cody's, okay, that everybody loved that went out of business. And then they ultimately vomited clam chowder down the front of the podium.
Jesus Christ, you guys. Skankwest Fest was fucking crazy. I gotta do this before I leave. It's 4:13 a.m. Monday morning. I'm leaving at fucking 2 hours in the wind and I'm back. It's never gonna work. I gotta go 8:15. I gotta leave in 2 hours. Alright, this gotta go fast. This gotta go fast. Guys, I gotta go fast. It's a great episode today. I've Chuck Palahniuk on the podcast. He was part of a thing called the Cacophony Society. The Cacophony Society pulled out high-scale pranks that were just ways to make you fucking see the world different. They had one where they just had a party where you just like dressed up in formal wear from the waist up, shorts from the waist down. They hiked 2 miles through sewers and up through storm drains and then just had a party. And if you saw this shit, you'd be like, wait, what the fuck are they doing? It's kind of like the early like flash mobs, you know, when you see suddenly everyone going to Michael Jackson Thriller dance. These guys are the ones who started that shit. The Santa Con, they started that shit. It became something different than they started it. And Chuck Palahniuk, you might know him from, he wrote Fight Club. He also wrote this book called Choke. He also wrote a bunch of books. That guy's got a fucking long list of books, dude. If you're looking for a book to read, Choke, I'd go with that. Chuck Palahniuk. Palahniuk, it's spelled. Choke. It's funny. It's interesting. Read it. Easter Bunny, Golden Gate Park, have a carrot. They'd have an Easter Bunny walk around through Golden Gate Park, somebody dressed like an Easter Bunny, and just go up to the little kids and be like, have a carrot. All fucking creepy. Give them carrots. Fucking nuts. I think we talked about it in this episode, but the fucking salmon swimming upstream is... So they would do things, the Cacophony Society, just to fuck with your mind. There's a new book that's out right now, Tales of the San Francisco Cacophony Society. It's available July 1st, so right now on Amazon. It's been republished. It's been out of print for fucking 10 years, I think, something like that. Go on Amazon right now, and they tell you tons of stories of these guys. Guys, okay, I'm not as high level as these people, but I will tell you that Luis J. Gomez, who thought he was not going to get revenged, he was in a MMA fight with his fucking former employee. Lost. I was the ref. I cheated in the favor of the employee, but afterwards, whatever, shit happened. The point is, he was knocked out on the fucking canvas of this ring, and I put my bare ass straight onto his fucking face. I mean, like, crack onto nose, straight down the middle, like fucking Luke Skywalker using the Force. I can hit this shot. I used to hunt wombats. Right down the fucking gut. One in a million shot. Nose in the asshole. Okay, revenge over. You guys, this episode is brought to you by Blue Chew. First of all, Blue Chew. That's BLUECHEW.com. Promo code Ari. Try it for free. It's dick pills, you guys. If you want to get a fucking boner, use dick pills. BlueChew.com. they fucking have dick pills to work. That's how it is. I'm just going to be like laying on the line. I'm pretty fucking drunk. I've been sleeping and waking up. I got to pack for Glastonbury. Anyway, BlueChew.com, like the color blue. It's not just for guys with dysfunction. It's for any guy who wants extra function and to enhance performance in the bedroom. All right. Please do not say per the FDA. Okay, no, I'm not going to say those. Guys, if you want to fucking, you should try it. Blue Chew. It's for every dude. BlueChew.com/promo code Ari. Try it for free. Just $5 shipping. You can get, it's just, they send you like 5 dick pills. You only need one, maybe two. And if you want to get 3, you're going to be fucking hard for like a month. Oh, fuck. Okay. Yeah, if you want to support the podcast and get rock hard cocks. BlueChew.com. So let's do it, I guess. I don't know what else I have to say. Guys, I'm gone right now. I said I was offline. I'm offline. Right now, July 8th, I'm in Spain, in Tosa de Mar. I'm probably coming back right today. Oh, fuck, I'm drunk. It was like yesterday I did a bunch of Molly. I was like, no, I got to go and pack, but somebody put Molly in my tongue. It was my fault. And then today, you know, Nick Cody was in town, so of course I'm going to drink. I'm offline. I'm living my life. Please, you guys, if you can, tell people to subscribe to this podcast. So, you know, when I do come back, if I post less, I'm going to need your help to fucking get the word out, to be able to fucking do the shit I do. The stuff you'd like to hear, just tell everybody to subscribe, leave a comment. I don't know if that matters, but like, I don't know. Have fun with it. Leave a comment. That's fun, I guess. Some dates, real quick. July 24th to 26th. I'm sorry, Montreal. July 24th to 26th at JFL. I'm doing Ari Shaffir's Renamed Storytelling Show. Indianapolis, July 31st at Helium. Milwaukee, August 4th at the Turner. Then Vegas, August 2nd, September 2nd and 3rd. To open up for Gary Vee. You guys, come support. Help him record his special, his CD, Vee to Las Vegas. Atlantic City, the Borgata, September 7th. Madison, Wisconsin, September 19th to 21st. Brea, California, September 26th to 28th. Dallas, October 3rd. Houston, 4th and 5th. Nashville, October 17th and 18th and 19th. Sal's wedding. Oh, no, that's not. San Jose Improv, November 7th through the 9th, Chicago at the Vic. I'm sorry, that's December. December 15th. Nope, that's November 15th. All tickets are available at arishaffir.com. Guys, I wish I had more time to go into the Cacophony Society. They were fucking tremendous. They did crazy shit. Me and Duncan formed something similar called the Los Angeles Society of Gentlemen Comedians. It was fucking tremendous. We came up with great ideas for what to do with Los Angeles. Bill Day, I believe the one I remember is Bill Day Escalator. Nope, standing. What's the one where you stand and move? It doesn't like go up steps, it just moves. You know, like a standing walkway, you know, moving walkway from Los Angeles and Santa Monica to Los Angeles and Sunset. We're going to petition the fucking government to change it, to make it happen. No one walks up there. I guess I'm doing a great job fucking mentioning it. Oh, fuck. I'm so fucking drunk and I gotta pack. I have no tent. I gotta pack this suit. I'm fucked. You guys, let's start the episode. Chuck Palahniuk, first of all. Okay, so he had me to his office. Oh, I gotta say this shit. Okay, I went to Portland. He was in Portland. He lives in Portland. He teaches a class. It's so fucking cool. He gets into it. He had me to his office, and we talked about the Cacophony Society. When I wanted to interview him, I was like, I wasn't sure yet. I just knew I loved his writing. I love Fight Club as well, which he also wrote the book for. And I wanted, and then as I was researching him, I found out about this Cacophony Society, these people who do large-scale crazy pranks. And he's like, what do you want to talk about? I was like, I thought dog ownership, just because like, you're a dog owner, and I figured it would be interesting talking about something you like. But now, all I want to talk about is the Cacophony Society. And he was like, fuck yeah, let's talk about that. It was great. He fucking did it. He's a fucking gentleman. Super smart. You guys will love him. Let's start the episode. Right? Nothing else to do. Let's start the fucking episode. Thanks for having me here. This place is cool. First of all, how do you say your name? Nobody knows.
We say it Polonik.
Damn it, that's what I was going to guess.
It's not the Ukrainian way, but you know, it's the way my family has always said it.
Yeah, that's cool. So I wanted to talk to you about, first of all, about just dogs. I usually do a topic on this. Just pick one topic with some sort of expert or somebody who has some experience or something. And just flesh out a topic.
Did you say dogs?
Yeah. I knew you're a dog owner, and I was like, it's anyone who has any sort of, like, interesting life, but then, like, you just pick a focus. You know, if you owned a boat, same shit.
I know a lot about my dog, but that's where it stops.
Well, that's the same thing. So I've interviewed my friends about being a parent, but they're not expert parents.
Okay.
They're just like, oh, I've raised two, so we'll see. But then this cacophony society thing, I've started doing more and more research on it. It's the best. How'd you get involved with it? Are they still around?
You know,
I got a billion questions.
Back in the late 80s, there was a posting on a telephone pole, just one of those Kinko's colored postings, and it said Contiki 2000. Tiki music party, and it was going to be held at this decrepit tiki bar, and so I went with friends, and it was these really nerdy, dweeby, the most uncool people you could imagine, and they were playing these collections of tropical music albums from the 1950s, the kind of background music you might hear in Tarzan movies. With lots of drums and lots of animal noises and lots of screeching parrots. And it was a big kind of luau party. But the best part was there were supposed to be voodoo weddings. And just as this place filled up with all of the kind of scenester people, the hip people who looked so good in their Jordache jeans and their everything 80s kind of... big hair, they started to do the voodoo weddings, and as part of the voodoo weddings they started throwing something into the crowd, and no one was sure what they were being struck by, these little wet bits of things.
Yeah.
And it turned out it was chicken entrails, and it was partially decomposed chicken entrails.
What?
And so it was so perfect because it was just like,
oh yeah, zombie
wedding.
Yeah.
But in Carrie, it was the cool people who suckered the nerd in and then dumped guts on her. But in the tiki party, it was the nerds that suckered the cool people in and then dumped blood and guts all over them. And so after that, I was just in love with cacophony.
So wait, what did you walk into? Like, what was your thought walking into that? Just a thing?
I thought it was just going to be a weird party with a bunch of people playing tropical music and a lot of... drinks served in ceramic skulls and fake volcanoes.
Yeah. I love those moments for like large scale pranks when it just like it reveals itself to you and you're just like, oh wow.
And people were running and screaming and clawing each other to get away from these.
Because it's hitting their normal clothes?
Yeah, they were all dressed up. It was Friday night. It was.
So then you're like, what'd you do? You just found like.
I loved it. My friends were really pissed off. My friends were furious that they'd been assaulted in this stinky chicken guts way. But I just thought it was marvelous. I thought it was the most fun I'd had any night in a long time.
When was this? Do you remember?
Geez, maybe 1989.
Damn.
Yeah.
And so you're just like, who's running this?
Yeah.
I want to. And who was it?
It was a group called the Cacophony Society that started in San Francisco called the Suicide Club.
Yeah.
And it was based on a Robert Louis Stevenson short story called The Suicide Club. And it was about people who wanted to live out their wildest adventures before they died. And in a way, it was maybe kind of a 19th century version of the bucket list.
Okay.
And Suicide Club pranked the Bay Area for years, and they started the Burning Man. They started so many things that have become institutionalized. They started Santa Rampage.
That is, I mean, I have to get into the anger of that because of what it's become.
So many things that Cacophony started have been co-opted in advertising. And so that is kind of the goal, according to Victor Turner, cultural anthropologist, is that you create these little experiments, these limnoid events. And if they really serve people, then eventually people, the society adopts them and institutionalizes them. And society picks up your baby and raises it for you. And you no longer really, you know, you have to give it away.
Yeah. Oh, wow. And then they get, money gets involved. And that's when advertising gets involved. Anything.
And Cacophony got none of that.
Yeah,
but
oh, yeah,
for
sure.
It was never about money. It was never about raising money.
Yeah. But it just must suck, too, because it seems like from the stuff I've read about the, what was it? Those anti-billboards.
Oh, the Billboard Liberation Fund?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This seems like the most antithetical thing to them. It's to, like, start this great prank and then have somebody come and use it for advertising, for just straight down the line advertising.
You know, but that kind of cultural jamming.
Yeah.
Again, going back to Victor Turner, if it appeals to people, if it really serves them, then people are going to adopt it. It's going to become the next standard.
What do you mean?
One standard prank was San Francisco has the Beta Breakers Marathon.
My friend used to go every year.
Tens of thousands of people, you know, run in this giant flood to the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So Cacophony built these enormous sequin salmon costumes that when you put them on, you're like 8 or 9 feet tall. And the idea was to wear these hideous, sweating, hot costumes and to run against the tide and to leap against the tide of runners and to be as obnoxious as possible.
They would jump up and like...
And so it looked like salmon swimming upstream. And it was such a striking, amazing, hilarious visual. First, people hated it because you were trying to run past these giant, scratchy sequin salmons. Say that three times fast. But then Nike picked it up, and it became
really?
Nike ad. And Nike made better salmons than we made.
They wow.
So, you know.
And they just started doing them every year?
Well, I think they did a season of Nike ads that included the salmon, and then it was passé. But that's the thing, is you want to present these things and see if the culture will pick them up and run with them.
Yeah. They have my friend tries to put around graffiti around the East Village, and he has to go to storefronts and like say, "Do you mind if we use your brick wall? It'll be cool, you know. You'll get some honor." Especially the Italians, they have to be like, "It'll be very honorable for you." And I'm like, "Okay, yeah, the high level artist, sure."
Well, in a way, Banksy has kind of done the same thing. He's legitimized this, and
yeah, you're right, huh? Where he just goes in and like makes you like wonder, like, "What is this thing?"
And before him was the other gentleman in the 80s who died just after Andy Warhol.
Black guy?
Yes. I didn't want to say the black guy, but yeah, the black guy. The
crazy hair guy? I don't know how you'd say it.
Guy, Basquiat? The crazy mother, yes.
Yeah.
And the good movie.
They had an exhibit at him at the Brooklyn Museum, and it was called One Basquiat, and it was just One Basquiat. That's the entire exhibit.
And I think Keith Haring was also part of that, legitimizing of graffiti.
Oh, yeah, maybe. And then you're right. So it becomes this thing, but then a lot of times advertising is the one who has to pay for it. They're like, you need supplies. Like, you need supplies for a salmon costume. So, like, Nike would be like, we'll get you a nice one. You know what
by
I mean?
By then, it's institutionalized. It's been co-opted. If you're financed by somebody else like that, yeah.
Do you guys have any rules?
You know, there were really no rules. The events had to be grassroots. People would propose events, and there would a mimeograph newsletter would go out. And if your event in the newsletter, you would say the time and the place, you'd say the theme, you would say what you were attempting to do.
What's mimeograph?
Like Xerox.
Okay.
And sheets of paper, Xeroxed, and
okay.
actually sent to people's houses with stamps. And if people liked it, they would show up in hordes, and they would all behave in character, and you would have a great event. But if it didn't resonate with people, you might get two or three people, and it would be kind of a sad, pathetic little event, and it would never happen again.
So do you, like, cross-check it with people? Like, what do you think of this? How can I tweak it to make it better and more interesting before you send it out to everybody?
You know, not necessarily. I think people just kind of dream up things, and then they would pitch them and put them in the newsletter, and that would be the end of it.
Okay, so hold on. Whose newsletter? Like, who's the board this of was the Cacophony Society?
The Cacophony Society. Marcy, who was known as Santa Cupcake, she was one of the ringleaders here, and then there was Reverend Chuck Linville, who was part of the art car crowd, people who would glue just about everything to a car and then drive it around.
And that kind of got going in Burning Man.
That, Burning Man, but even before Burning Man, because with Reverend Chuck, it started with that archetypal day when you put your coffee mug on top of your car, and the whole way to work, you're thinking, where's my coffee mug? But people are pulling next to you on the freeway, and they're pointing at your car, and they're laughing because your coffee mug's on your car. And he loved the attention so much that he glued a coffee mug to the top of his car.
Oh, that's great.
Because that way, everywhere he went, happy, smiling people were laughing okay. and pointing at him. And it was just, it was like being a celebrity.
It's also great because it's such a low damage. It's not like leaving a baby stroller on your car. A baby basket, you know, where people are going to be like ruin their day mentally. Well,
and then he, right, exactly. He eventually did do that. But the coffee mug morphed into a coffee maker and a coffee mug and cream and sugar. And that morphed into a tray of like a room service tray of breakfast.
So then you're attacking the setup. You're not just right. attacking the idea. You're attacking the setup of the idea.
You're taking it farther and farther Whoa. And farther until it becomes obvious it's deliberate. And then it becomes kind of art.
Yeah. You ever see Jackass?
Yeah, oh, my gosh. Yeah, Johnny Knox.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you know the one where we were just talking about it, where Wee Man was on a date with another little person in a bar, and then her jealous ex-boyfriend little person came in and starts, and then all these other patrons are just looking at this, like, midget fight, you know? And then and then the little people police come in, and then little people's okay, ambulance okay. comes in, and they're just like, all right. But there's a moment where you're like, oh, this is a put on, you know? But it's so great until then. Which ones did you dream up?
Boy, you know, I'm not sure if I ever came up with any. No, I know I didn't. I just ripped them off.
Oh, really?
I used them, the whole idea of these stunts, these kind of theme party stunts, as my source for Project Mayhem in Fight Club. Yeah, people being given these envelopes that would invite them to take part in a big kind of act of civil disobedience or sort of a big flash mob kind of thing. So they were the inspiration for Project Mayhem. But I participated in events, but I never actually hosted one.
Why?
Well, you know, because in a way, my book events ultimately became those things, because the book events became these big, interactive, very physical, screaming, yelling, prize-filled, stunt-filled things.
Really? Somebody, I read somewhere, but I didn't read into it yet. Like, somebody was, like, fucking with you, one of your book events.
Oh, that's about every single one.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Cacophony showed up at one of mine, and they all showed up as waiters with black eyes, and then they all showed up, and they threw dinner rolls at each other throughout this event in Berkeley at the old, what was the bookstore on Telegraph? Cody's. Cody's okay. that everybody loved that went out of business. And then they ultimately vomited clam chowder down the front of the podium.
What do you mean vomited?
A guy with at least a mouthful, if not a stomachful, dressed as a waiter, came to the podium and barfed it all over the front.
I mean, are you aware of who those people are in the audience?
I did. Okay. I knew them all from Cacophony. So
when you see them there, you're like, let's see how far I get.
Yeah.
Project Mayhem, though, was a lot more violent than this seems to be.
Mm. Yeah, you know, there was never really a sort of an ugly side to Cacophony. Occasionally, they would do events that I could not get behind.
Morally?
Ethically and on every aspect of taste, there was a traditionally they would crucify a giant, like 8-foot stuffed carnival sized stuffed pink rabbit. They would crucify it, hold a pageant play, and crucify it in front of a black church here in Portland. So they would be crucifying this giant pink rabbit on a telephone pole outside the doors of this black church as all these parishioners were coming out on Easter morning. And I could not get behind that. That was just a little too mean-spirited.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the meanness. There's like these light tweaks in giant pranks where it's just like, I don't know, it's like the tone or something where you're like, I don't know, man, they've dealt with this enough.
You know, the chicken guts was a little bit that way, mm-hmm. but in a way it was assaulting people who really had power in that situation. The people who had just shown up for the scene, the people who are so heavily made up and so beautifully dressed and so about looking good.
Yeah.
You don't mind seeing those people lose power. It really depends on, you know, who you're pranking.
Yeah, little kids, too. It's like, that's a tough one.
Well,
unless they're just being fooled.
And the wonderful thing about Santa Rampage is that when you would rampage as part of 800, 900 Santas, what they used to call the Red Tide, all these people identical, no gender, no race, nothing. They're just all called Santa. And we would spend weeks wrapping little presents, little toys and stuff. And so all these Santas, if we came across kids, we would just kind of bomb the kid in little presents.
With toys.
And the kids loved it.
Because it was actually shit they could use.
Yeah, like, well, there were anything. All these little prizes, these little, almost Cracker Jack little things.
Mm-hmm.
The parents were terrified because the parents didn't have a context and a lot of the Santas were drunk out of their minds.
Yeah.
The kids loved it.
So in those days of SantaCon or Santa Rampage, I know how it is now. It's a blight on New York.
Oh, really? Is it really?
Oh, yeah. Dude, the club I work at has super strict. Like, if you're wearing any red, you're not coming in today. Yeah. They're the worst. They're just like barf at 2 p.m. people.
Do they do the Windex thing?
Not that I know of.
Because
what is it?
That was a traditional Santa way of drinking in public, is everyone would bring empty washed out Windex bottles and fill them with Gordon's gin, which is the same color as Windex.
Yeah.
And so you just spray each other in the mouth with gin all night. Or they would put gin and really high grade marijuana in these bottles.
Yeah.
And it they would
That's a good combo.
Steep this dope in this gin. And it made a liqueur, a tincture they called reindeer fucker. So people would be getting stoned on reindeer fucker all night. And
That's so great. So the point was just to, like in the beginning, the point was just to go around making people look at them and then having a good time at the same time.
You know, the point was just to do something outside of their very boring lives. Because most of the people in Cacophony, if you took a poll, it would probably be 30% of them worked for the Postal Service.
Oh, man.
They were letter carriers. They were people who just had these very robotic jobs. And at the time, I had an assembly line robotic job that was just the same thing over and over. And we needed to schedule this kind of community and chaos in our lives. And in a way, Cacophony just gave us a script and roles to play for a very small window of complete chaos.
It must have been, so if you come from that life, from that, like, you know, boring job, whatever, and then these are super creative, just moments. What's the feeling inwards of, like, is it like a freedom, a mental freedom? Or, like, how would you describe it?
It's kind of a, boy, I hate to refer to popular art, but there was a semi-popular kind of art house movie about... what did they used to call them? The parties that were held in warehouses. You would just throw it up for one night and people would come. It would be a secret party. What were those called?
Raves.
Raves.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think the movie might have been called Rave.
Really?
Maybe.
Who was in it?
Anyway. Linkletter.
Okay.
But part of it, and there's a little soliloquy at the end where the organizer of this rave, he says he does it for the nod, that at some point in the evening, some total stranger will come up to him and nod and say, thank you for doing this. I really needed it. I needed something like this.
Oh, wow.
And in Cacophony, it's about, really, you're about hosting an event, and you're about doing sometimes weeks and weeks and weeks of planning and strategizing and gathering of stuff and marshaling of people to make this happen. And you're not making it happen for yourselves. You're making it happen for the innocent people who will wander into it and think, what the hell is this? And they will have the time of their life. And in a way, you're just, you're like an author or anyone creative. You're trying to create an event in their lives that's unlike anything they've ever experienced.
It'll be like nothing they've ever experienced.
And they will walk away saying, I have no idea what that was, but they will talk about it for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. And you probably won't always be able to see the look on their face, but you know one of them is going to have that look like a week later. She's going, what the fuck was that?
And some of them are actually going to inquire, and they will become part of Cacophony.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of them will just, you know, self-select to say, that was insane. Those people are crazy.
Yeah.
And disregard it. But the majority of people will be absolutely delighted that somebody bothered to make that weird thing happen.
Do you know Shepard Fairey, the graffiti artist? He does the Obey Giant stencils that are everywhere, and then he went on to do bigger stuff. But that was a project in college for him, I think at RISD, where he just put it up over a political campaign billboard, the stencil of Andre the Giant, this wrestler.
Okay, I know that.
Yeah. And the point was, one, to fuck with this political campaign, but two, because then he started giving the stencils out to everybody, so just put it up wherever, is to make you, like, re-look at your surroundings. So, like, if you pass this warehouse every day on the way to work, and then suddenly you see this Andre the Giant stencil on it, then you're just like, wait, what is this place? What warehouse? What do they make here? It just makes you, like, kind of wake up to, like, your surroundings in general.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this is that same sort of thing, where it's like, wait, what? Like, who are these people? What just went on? And it just, like, wakes you up from this, like, you know, this rote way of, like, everything going exactly the same every day.
You know, Portland, and I'm still sure it still does. It would have, Portland had an event called First Thursday,
mm-hmm.
where the first Thursday of every month, all the galleries would open their new shows, and all the galleries were more or less within walking distance of one another, and people would put on nice clothes after work, and it was a very networking, very cheese and red wine kind of, you know, stroll around from gallery to gallery. And so we found a gallery that was going out of business. And we asked if we could have their gallery for the last First Thursday.
Yeah.
And we filled it with the worst string art and sad-eyed kitty art and the worst art that we could find from Goodwill and created the Art Mall, just the worst art gallery of all time. And we had bad mimes, and we had bad conceptual performance art, and we had a lot of bad red wine.
I'm trying to think what these rich people would think of it.
And all these wonderful people who wandered through ended up staying in our gallery. And it was just a gigantic, the kind of party you fantasized that Andy Warhol would have had, where he was kind of showing art but making fun of art, and also making fun of people who were so pretentious about art.
Oh, yeah. There's so much of that. Wearing giant question marks on their hats and like, what is this? Who are you guys?
And what's it worth?
Yeah. You know? Oh, it's all what it's worth.
Is this a good investment? Should I buy this?
Every artist I've ever dated, they're always like, the only reason the art world exists is from rich wives trying to spend their husband's money. So like, you have to price it high for all of this to like, go on.
And the Art Mall was kind of the opposite. It was just a chance to kind of give people this place to almost be children again. But again, like you said, refresh the way that they saw the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, those are fun. What other ones have you been into? I wrote some of these down. I want to hear about them, too.
Boy, La Art Mall. There used to be a giant Alice in Wonderland. I think it might have been another Easter event where people would go out dressed, before they called it cosplay, they'd go out dressed as Alice in Wonderland characters, and they would bring these big 50-pound sledgehammers, and we would play croquet in a public park.
With sledgehammers?
And bowling balls.
Oh, that's nice.
So you're slamming these bowling balls through wickets that are made out of bent rebar. So the wickets are huge and heavy, and the bowling balls are huge and heavy. And everyone's dressed up and sweating like pigs in these giant costumes.
Really swinging these hammers.
And so, yeah, that was a blast.
So when you do those, you have to, like, commit to the game, too. You can't be, like, hamming up and be looking around.
No, everyone's very, very much in character. You know, when you do Santa Rampage, everyone's name is Santa. Or they're Santa something. Marcy McFarlane was always Santa Cupcake.
Uh-huh.
So everyone has got a Santa something name.
And what would you do? Just go around the town, just
the host like, puts together an itinerary. The way of traffic.
Yeah,
and so you always know if you lose track of the Santas, if you stay in one bar too long, you know where to catch them 2 hours later. So you know roughly where they're going to be.
Oh, okay, so it was always a bar crawl.
Kind of, but they would also crash great big like. If there was a very pretentious kind of art museum benefit party that night, the Santas would attempt to crash it.
Oh, man.
So they try to get into every level of a public event.
The best is when you tell me, when you get the people who just have no sense of humor about it and be like, stop it, no. And then I can imagine that would just make you go double down.
You know, and those people are pretty intimidated when they come up against 800 or 900 Santas.
Drunk.
The Iditarod,
uh-huh.
The urban Iditarod, where people, you use shopping carts as sleds.
Uh-huh.
You basically stage the Iditarod through like 35 miles of city
with teams
of people pulling the shopping carts in harness. And people riding in the shopping carts and all these different shopping cart teams racing each other through the city.
Oh, Jesus.
Sometimes at night, so there's less traffic. Boy, there was stripper bingo.
The injuries on Iditarod, urban Iditarod, those things are not made for that at all.
Well, and so many jackass pranks involved shopping carts.
Yeah, it reminds me of this completely, where they're just like...
Cacophony was doing it 20 years before Jackass.
Wow. Before any of that.
Yeah.
I thought Jackass and Tom Green were like the early, like it's the first time I've ever seen anything like that. And both of them were kind of doing it at the same time.
No, Cacophony was way before. Cacophony actually started doing a lot of this in the 70s.
Way before film.
Do you remember Harold and Maude?
Mm-hmm.
Harold and Maude, at one point, they're passing a stretch of beach in the Bay Area. And you see these kind of plywood rotting sculptures there in the foreground. They just pass them.
Okay.
That was the first Burning Man. That was the remains of the first Burning Man, which was held on the beach instead of Nevada. And so that first Burning Man dates back to what, 1972?
Damn.
Yeah.
And what was the theory of it back then?
You know, it was just a chance to get together and do this kind of art thing that would be destroyed. Everyone would make art exhibits and specialized camps, and they would all be destroyed. They'd be very short-lived.
I'm going through this thing now in my head where everyone's, you know, especially with cell phones, where it's like, take a picture, take a video, and then you'll see something on the subway and somebody will be playing and you'll be watching it, but then you'll see behind that person playing, you know, cool guitar or whatever, seven other people film. It's like, you guys are in each other's shots. And like, none of you are just like having the experience.
And that was kind of the preciousness of Cacophony, is that if magic happened, it was even more magic because it was temporary. And then it was gone.
Fleeting and then done forever.
And thank God if magic didn't happen, you could walk away and pretend it never happened.
Yeah. What was the other one you were going to tell me about?
Stripper bingo.
Yeah.
Everyone would go to a huge stripper bar like the Acropolis here in Portland, and they would all have cards that would all have typical stripper moves on them. And if the stripper slapped her ass or licked her finger or did some very stereotypical stripper thing, you would mark your card in the appropriate square. And whoever, you know, got a full bingo first would win prizes. So stripper bingo was a big thing. Sometimes it did wed these kind of underworld things or sort of...
What do you mean?
Well, strippers are not really a mainstream thing.
Oh, underworld like that, yeah.
At least they didn't used to be. And it was a way of kind of wedding this kind of church-type activity, bingo, with this... not underworld, but not societally appropriate, approved activity.
Old version of Times Square kind of place.
Yeah.
Where it's like, yeah, under belly of society. I wanted to do this thing that I never got around to, and now I'm fucking pissed at myself. I was raised Orthodox Jewish, so I wanted to go to a synagogue for like a few weeks, get them to know me, you know, just like be there every Shabbos. And then on the way out one time, just have a hooker pass by and just start making out with her in front of all these, like, you know, curly fried Jews, and then just walk on as if nothing happened. Just like, those are the moments where you just have people like, what? I mean, it's like a jump starter of life.
And it gives them something to talk about. They really have to go into community to process, to digest and assimilate the event.
Yeah.
They have to be with other people to talk about it.
Yeah, because if it's just you, it's almost like it didn't happen, right?
Right.
You got to be a little like, hey, look at what is this?
That's like the old Bill Murray joke where he's famous for approaching people in public. And if they make eye contact with him, he'll run over and he'll grab them and shake them or he'll kiss them. And then he'll say, and nobody is going to believe this happened. And then he'll walk away, leaving the person frustrated knowing.
No one will.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. That's great. There's this Tom Hanks, this dude from like Auburn or Alabama or something. They won a big game. College football, and this guy was passed out drunk on a table, and he picked the guy's head up. Tom Hanks just saw him, picked his head up, took his phone. You can, like, on iPhones you can take a picture, but you can't access the rest of the phone. Mm-hmm. And he just took a selfie with this guy passed out and then put it back down. And then he found it later. It's like, when did I meet Tom Hanks? What is this? Yeah, these moments are so fucking good. But you really need that. That's perfect for Bill Murray too, because no one would.
And that was the other glorious thing about cacophony, is that they had to be public things. Because really what you're doing is you're serving the public with this spectacle.
Oh, yeah.
There's no point in, you know, doing it just yourselves.
Mm-mm. Yeah, there's really not. I got lucky one time. I got my friend to cover, this is going to get gross, but I got my friend to cover my other friend's car in human feces. He put it under the door handles, and then he put it on the windshield wipers, and then he just left his car at the Comedy Store and then turned the windshield wipers on, but no motor on. And we're like, we're not going to be here for the payoff. But he was calling me and left a message after he had to deal with the door handle stuff. And he's like, all right, I know this is you. It's got your fucking name on it completely. I had to pay a homeless guy to like take the shit out of the door handles. And he goes, when I find you, and then you can hear the car starting right then. And it's just a spread of shit over the windshield as the windshield, and he was just like, no. And it was like, we couldn't believe we actually got to see it. But if you don't, it's all worthless.
Well, and again, cacophony is not about pranking individuals in that kind of damaging way.
Yeah,
it's always about sort of creating that weird just sort of messing with their meme.
So did you have any rules about like monetary or physical damage? That's always my line. No monetary or physical damage to anybody on pranks.
Exactly. Well, that, and also no sort of taking away their respect. That was what I liked most about the Exotiki, the tropical wedding party thing, was the people staging it behaved as if they had no respect. They weren't about looking good. And they were having a great time because they weren't sitting there worried about, you know, dominating others by looking good. Because that's how we are most of the time, is we are about dominating other people by looking good and being right. And the Exotiki is about sort of allowing people to be fools by demonstrating being fools in this really public way and giving people license themselves to be a little foolish and step away from having to look good all the time.
Wow. Yeah, I like that. Where it's like, we're not making fun of you. But join.
Exactly. Yeah. And like an invitation to, you know, you can be a little crazy for a couple minutes because we're crazier than you are.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Silliness is like, well, you guys are way going for it. So I can like put my foot in the water at least.
And so often when I read work in public, it's about reading work that completely destroys my dignity. That the story I read guts that makes people faint. When you read that story in public, people don't see it as a story. They see it as something that you yourself experienced as a confession. And so it completely robs me of any human dignity. But at the same time, it's being read to young people. And the only power that most young people have is their looking good, is their youth, their good lookingness, their vitality. And what they fear most is losing that looking good power, because it's all they have.
So because they're so unskilled at everything, because they're just so young.
They don't have contacts, they don't have wealth, they don't have resources, they have youth.
Wow, what an interesting idea.
And so when you show somebody giving up that power willingly and still having power, still willing to be there, they really respond to that, because it's their worst fear.
It's not looking good.
Right, is being humiliated, losing their status, not looking good.
My friend, we were skiing, and we were trying the terrain parks, you know, where you do little jumps and stuff. And they're for 19-year-olds, and we're in our 40s, and we're like, let's try. And we're barely going for the smallest ones, but we're having a blast. And he was like, you know, it's weird. If we were their age, we'd be too embarrassed to not do this as great as they are. But here we are in our mid-40s. We're like, can we go next, guys? And do these little tiny, like, 2-inch jumps. And it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. They're not like, get out of here, old man.
And it's nice when you demonstrate that, because you give everybody else the same permission to not have to look good, to risk looking bad for a moment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What is Good Will Hunting? Do you remember that one? I read about some of these.
Good Will Hunting. Now, that's the movie.
I think it's spelled Goodwill, like the organization. Goodwill and then Hunting.
I don't know that one.
Damn. Oh, I was like, what did you guys do to Goodwill?
There was Drive-by Shooting Gallery, which was part of Burning Man, where they would have these enormous stuffed animals set up in the desert, and you would drive by at 60 or 70 miles an hour in a Jeep filled with people with rifles and pistols and every kind of firearm. And people would just blast away at these things as they passed them. And then there was also Big Car Hunting, where there was a remote-controlled, giant, huge 70s-era station wagon. And it was remote-controlled. And so people would chase it in these safari parties as someone in the distance piloted it around the desert. And all these different safari, you know, Jeep wagoneers, whatever, they would chase this giant car and they would shoot at it.
And because no one's in it.
Right. And they would blow out the tires and they'd blow out the windshield. They'd blow out holes in it. And then once it broke down completely, they would fix it so they could chase it around and around again and blow it apart again.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
A lot of this was done by the disgruntled postal workers camp, because so many cacophony society people were postal workers. And they would host a camp that was just postal workers in their postal uniforms.
At Burning Man?
Carrying sidearms. Yeah.
It was carrying sidearms. Yeah. But I don't think a lot of people remember now that was a normal thing for a postal worker to go crazy and just shoot up his job.
Going postal.
Yeah. When was that? Like 90s?
Boy, no, it was back in the 80s, maybe even late 70s, the first ones.
Yeah, they were getting, they weren't being paid enough, or it was just so boring that they broke?
I saw so many documentaries. It was about a lot of people went into the Postal Service in management positions from the military.
Oh.
And so they had a very military mindset about how much work had to be done in a certain period of time. And if the work wasn't done, people were really punished for it. And so there was so much pressure to work.
Especially for the people who weren't in the military.
Right.
We're like, why am I being driven like I'm a fucking private when I'm just working for the government? Sorting mail. It shouldn't be this pressure filled. It'll be here tomorrow.
There's so much on like YouTube about why people went postal. So many documentaries.
Yeah, it was so weird. It was like a real thing. Yeah. It wasn't just one or two.
It's kind of, it's gone away because
it has.
It's overall become, you know, under the umbrella of workplace violence.
Oh. So, yeah, right. Other places get shut up now.
Beer distributors and it's every business.
Yeah. They all get shut up. Man, I got to do more research on that. That was such a big thing. I completely forgot about it. Going postal. Oh, so you guys would fuck with it by like.
My friends who were postal carriers, letter carriers, would fuck with it by just claiming it.
Yeah.
And being the disgruntled postal workers camp.
That's the best, too, when you just claim it, when you don't try to go like, no, it's not. Most of us are fine. Just like, we get it. We get why the stereotype is there. It's happened. But that's not us. So
you deny the drama of it. And by denying the drama of it, you really take away all of its power. you make it a cliche and you kind of give people permission to laugh at it. So yeah. It no longer really carries that kind of terror.
When we were in high school and in grade school, we heard, it was all Jews, and we heard the idea that we're cheap. We didn't know, and it didn't affect us one way or the other. We didn't have any money. It was all our parents' money anyway. You know, we're in seventh grade. But once we heard about it, we didn't care. We just started playing this game called Get It Jews. And if you had like 5 or 6 pennies in your pocket, just you'd surprise everybody and just yell, Get It Jews, and then throw the pennies. And we'd go full purge, full Hunger Games to try to get those pennies. And the rabbis were like, stop playing that game. It's so embarrassing. But we didn't care.
That's hilarious. Yeah,
we just didn't give a shit. It was like, I don't know.
There was a real phase when people were reclaiming language in a real similar way. And handicapped people wanted to be called cripples.
Uh-huh.
And gay people wanted to be called queers.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
It was really that owning the language was part of a movement in the 80s that kind of disappeared.
To knock it down, to give it no power.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I remember queer. Yeah. Where it was like, no, that's fine. Do it. And then it has nothing to do with us. And by the way, it worked because you call somebody queer now. It's like, what? What are you from the 70s? Who says that anymore?
That so much of cacophony fits in with the philosophy of Michel Foucault, who, you know.
Not familiar. I never heard her name, but that's it.
His name.
Damn it. As soon as you just blinked enough that I was like, I know I'm wrong.
French guy. And so much of what he wrote about was the fact that that when we resist something, we give it more power. But if we come to a kind of third alternative, or if we don't react to it, don't give it drama, then we take away all of its power. And so I always see this demonstrated in, you know, what is the difference between in The Silence of the Lambs when Miggs ejaculates in Jodie Foster's hair?
Uh-huh.
And she's screaming, and everyone's screaming. And even Anthony Perkins is appalled. I would not have let something so horrible happen to you. And he gives her a towel, thank God. And then Jodie Foster's got cum in her hair, and it's just this hideous, shrieking apex of that scene. But then in The Trouble, Something About Mary.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Cameron Diaz ends up with cum in her hair, and we're all laughing.
Because no pack, she's not embarrassed, she's not like... Yeah, wow, you're right.
So it's whether you play the scene for laughs or for drama. And so much of Foucault was about demonstrating how you take away the power of something by not reacting to it in a dramatic way.
Where should I start with him if I wanted to read something?
Look for an introduction.
Okay.
Because he is fantastically dense in that kind of French deconstructing way. So an introduction. Or even an overview of Foucault and Derrida.
Okay. That's hilarious, too. Like, in Silence of the Lambs, they're wearing human skin, and the biggest freak out is semen in your hair.
Well, in the book, which I thought was terrific,
mm-hmm.
Thomas Harris, in the Silence of the Lambs book, there's a little tagged-on bit in that scene where she's back at the FBI Quantico dorm where she lives with her best friend, and they're doing their laundry. And her best friend says, so what'd you do with your day? And she says, I wheedled a psycho with cum in my hair. And her best friend says, wow, some people have all the fun. And that's where the scene actually ends. But if you put that in the movie, it would have flattened the tension from that moment. It would have completely dispelled all the horror of that moment.
Yeah.
And in a movie, you've got 2 hours and you need that horror to keep rolling forward and accumulating. So you can't have those little tension cuts the books can have.
Isn't it weird, though, in moments, when something bad happened to you, missing your bus to another town or getting robbed or something like that, it's like horrible. But then telling the story later, I mean, I guess it's time equals funny, but like time and distance, but like people are like, oh, that sounds amazing. So would you have to hitchhike to Phnom Penh? Like, that's nuts. But at that time, like, fuck, this sucks. And then it becomes something like braggadocious.
Oh, geez, was it Stalin who said history repeats itself, first as tragedy and then second as comedy?
Oh, interesting.
So, you know, I think that's why we tell stories, why we have to talk about these things, because it, in the repetition, we exhaust them and we destroy the drama of them.
Yeah, you've lost his power just by talking about it over and over again.
Nora Ephron's heartburn. Toward the end, she says, my friends always tell me, why do you turn everything into a story? Why do you make everything into a story? And she says, because even if, no matter how sad it is, if I can turn it into a story, I can make you laugh at it. And I can make you laugh at it instead of laughing at me. And I have control over it.
Oh, interesting.
And it's a terrific book.
There's one comedian I know. A lot of comics have this problem now. I don't know how it's in the art, in the writing world, but this like pride in victimhood, sort of like, my dad's a Holocaust survivor, but he's not moaning about it ever. Actually, he had trouble even talking about it. But now it's just like, yeah, there was this kid we were friends with in a camp, you know, and he would just tell us about these games. But there's one comedian who was Miss Pat molested. I think she had her second baby at 15. But she just treats it as funny. And then you don't really feel bad for her. You're just laughing at this crazy thing that happened to her, you know, 25 years ago.
Well, you know, also, she's demonstrating that you can survive a thing and that you can turn it into a thing by which you actually profit from. You can make money from the thing and disempower it at the same time.
Right, right, right.
And you're proving to people that they have that same ability to move past the event, to turn it into even a livelihood, but to use it instead of being used by it for the rest of their life.
Yeah. Who are you going to let own this?
Exactly.
I mean, same thing with breakups, I guess. Right? Like, how long are you going to like let them have power over you?
Right. And breakups are terrific. That's fantastic creative energy. Getting dumped.
My worst moments, Joe Rogan, I think you've met him, but like he's had to talk me through. He's like, dude, this will be good for you. I know you don't want to hear it now, but change is good. And I'm like, fuck you. I'm crying every day. But it's he's right, you know. It's like, yeah, this is just overall, it just jumpstarts you.
Last year,
I love getting dumped. What a great, yeah.
Last year, the whole nightmare mess, I found out that the accountant in charge of my money in New York, the accountant for the agency that represents me,
yeah,
had been embezzling money from me for 21 years.
Fuck.
And the forensic accounting only went back for 10 years. That's all they could afford. And it was like $1.5 million just in the first 10 years. And I was wondering, why don't I have any money? Why am I never getting paid for my work? And
oh, Jesus.
And at the time, it just all fell to pieces. But after it fell to pieces, my screen representative, my screen agent, came to me and said, you know, for years and years, for 20 years, we've been getting requests for you to do script doctoring and do television shows and to do all this very lucrative screen work. But your book agent has forbidden me to bring you any of these offers because he doesn't want you to leave books. Because so many book authors cut their teeth with a couple books and then they start writing for Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And he says, I'd like to start bringing you screen work. And guess what?
What?
Screen work is incredibly lucrative.
You've been doing it?
I've started it. We've got a television series in the works. It's fantastic.
Do you, I'm sorry, but do you worry at all about Holden Caulfield's brother, where he's like, he used to be a writer and now he's in LA and writing garbage?
You know, I'm always going to be writing books.
Yeah.
And if I, you know, if I can help it, I'm always going to be writing comics because each one gives you a different sort of collaborating team of much younger, fantastically gifted people to work with.
Illustrators,
yeah. Letterers, colorers, and they are always so enabling in a really evil way that even if I suggest something really upsetting, we've got all these sex club scenes in Fight Club 3.
Uh-huh.
And I know from reports that Stephen Hawking really liked to go to these kind of down and dirty places.
Fucking yes, I
and
love that.
He loved to get lap danced. I think that's so appealing. Yeah. That he wasn't just a brain in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
That this guy had a real physical side to him. That this guy was a guy.
Uh-huh.
And he liked hot women to gyrate naked.
Like every man, pretty much, every heterosexual man. Like,
put him on a bed.
But you would not expect that of that, yeah.
And these naked, fantastically attractive women would love the honor of lap dancing Stephen Hawking. So I said, let's put Stephen Hawking in the sex club and give him a lap dance. And at first everybody said, no, we can't do it.
In this TV show?
No, in this comic, okay. In Fight Club 3. And then he died. And all the artists said, no, we really can't do it.
Why now?
Well,
once he's gone, you can go to town.
Eventually they did it.
Oh, great.
And the panels are fantastic. And they don't
also, it's a freedom
anybody.
To them. It's like, guys, I'm giving you this gift. Draw Stephen Hawking getting jerked off or getting a lap dance. It's like, come on.
And they don't disrespect him, but that's the kind of enabling that that you get in collaborations. If you don't have the nerve to do it yourself, there's always going to be somebody else in the collaboration who'll say, I think we can do it. You know, if we observe certain parameters, certain, you know, discretion, we can do it. And also, you know, certain, you know, legal limitations in terms of image.
Sure. Yeah.
We can do it.
Yeah. I just saw some show, I might not, a couple of years ago, but it was just Hitler showed up at their Brooklyn party. Like, I guess he hadn't died and just like was the cool new boyfriend of this guy's ex.
And you know that.
And everyone loved him.
Somebody brought that up in the writer's room and half the people said, no, let's not do that. But somebody said, I think we can do that. I think it might work.
And I'm glad they did. It stuck in my head. So, yeah, it's totally worth it. So you're going to start doing scripts now?
Yeah, I can't say really anything about the show. But, yeah, it's going to really out dark Black Mirror.
Really?
Yeah.
Drama. Or interesting?
Drama and everything. Drama and, you know, for me, you know, I was taught that the idea is to make people really laugh hard and at the last moment to break their heart as severely as you can in the last moment. And so that's always the goal.
Those Black Mirrors are fucking crazy.
You know, but the one thing that's not working with Black Mirror is that they are so standalone, so each one is so autonomous that that people are identifying which ones work, quote unquote, and which ones are less rewarding. And they're creating lists, so some of the episodes have a lot of viewership, and some of the episodes have very little viewership.
All right, because nobody talks about it. Nobody talks about a bad one, or whatever, quote-unquote bad one.
Or they talk about it in a negative way. They say, this one episode isn't worth your time to watch.
My favorite of those is you bring it up to somebody who's just not made for it, and they're like, I don't like that. It made me feel weird. You're like, oh, which one is that? I got to check that one out.
And a lot of my students say, they can't binge watch them, that they have to step away from them for 20 minutes to 2 hours before they can bother to watch another one.
Yeah.
They really have to assimilate. They really have to process.
I've had so many of those where I finish the episode and then I just turn the TV off and just sit there and I just don't move for about an hour.
You sound like my student, Trisha. She really? Does the same thing. Yeah.
And it's just like, what? And then I just try to like put it into my own life and then the world around me. I'm like, Jesus, it's also like real, you know, like it's like 3 years away, a lot of this shit from being like, that could easily happen.
And that's the kind of stuff I get to do now.
Really?
Because I got embezzled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
everything
that's
fell apart, but now everything's going back together in a much better way.
Yeah. And that's what you're talking about too, about like not letting the victimhood own you.
Right. You're
like, oh,
right.
Now I got to do this other thing because of that.
Yeah, exactly.
When's it going to come out?
You know, I can't even talk about that.
Fuck. Okay.
You know, these things, they come together so quickly and they go into production so quickly and there's no longer really a season to launching things anymore. So, yeah.
Wow, that's cool. What was I going to say? Here's some other ones. Tell me what these you remember. Good one, Honey Sugar Bingo. Ice Cream Antisocial. Spam Poetry Reads. The Great Pumpkin Short.
Scam Poetry Reads would be very much like the Art Mall.
It sounds like,
where you sucker people into what seems like a legitimate cultural event and then
have the worst.
Horrible stuff. I don't remember the Ice Cream Social.
Ice Cream Antisocial. Did you ever see that TED Talk of that guy who had no expertise who went in there to a regional TED Talk and just saw how long he could, like, dance around a topic? And he was like, oh, well, you know, and it's all these like metaphors that they always use in these TED Talks. And he was just using those, these tropes of like, okay. and saying nothing for the longest amount of time. I got to find out which one that was. It was so good, but only if you're in on it. And then everyone in the audience is not in on it. And they're just like, mm-hmm, interesting. They're just happy to be there as like intelligentsia.
Because I understood that the TED Talks were really fantastically rehearsed so that, you know, every minute, it had to be down to the minute. The timing had to be perfect.
And they okayed him with you? They okayed him with the speaker?
Right. That they must have had to rehearse this guy.
Yeah. I wonder if he got it. I got to find out the story behind that.
The regional ones or the TEDx ones might not be nearly as choreographed as the big TED ones.
Yeah.
But I had a friend who did one, and she said it was kind of a misery because she had to do it dozens of times.
So for them?
It would fill exactly the window of time.
That's weird.
You know, getting back to that idea of making people laugh and then breaking their heart,
mm-hmm.
the first time I ever saw Whoopi Goldberg, she did a stand-up routine, and it was on an award show. I can't remember what the show was, but it was about being a black surfer chick in Los Angeles and how she had a thing with this white surfer guy, and she was always hanging out. She finally got it on with him. They hooked up and blah, blah, blah. And then she gets pregnant. And by the end of this funny story where everybody's laughing at, she is in a public restroom at the beach giving herself a coat hanger abortion. This is on television.
What?
This
fuck.
Is on cable television. But at the end of that, you could hear a pin drop. And then at the end, she comes back to this upspeak, valley speak, surfer speak, y'all, you should come down to the beach and hang out with me sometime. It's fun. And by the time she comes back to this goofiness, it's heartbreaking. And people are weeping. And it was one of the most powerful comedy things I'd ever seen because it did evolve from this light, funny, goofy thing into this fantastically sordid, tragic thing that tried to redeem itself with comedy at the end, and that made it even more tragic.
And so she didn't like... I call it like popping the balloon of tension, where it's like sometimes you build this thing up, but then as an audience member, you're like, please pop that before you leave.
No, you know, in a way, she sort of brought people down, and then the attempted comedy at the end made it even more sad because it was a failure to recognize. It was a failure for her to kind of, as a character, to recognize and deal with a horror. It was a further denial of the horror. And so it left people really shaken at the end.
Because she wasn't dealing with it?
Right.
Wow.
And my favorite writers do that. They don't dictate how people should emotionally react to the work. They just present the work, and they allow people to have their own emotional reaction without being prompted.
I got to try to find that thing. The internet's the best now. Yeah, I love those two. I've seen them in stories before, in comedy stories, but they set the scene of like a Cuban funeral, and it's like you see all the crazy details and you're laughing and laughing and laughing until you find out like who the funeral's for, and you're like, "Aw, your mom or the woman you cared about the most in the world," but you can't go into it with that emotional endpoint.
Right. You've got to really seduce people with a lot of laughter before you take them to that completely upsetting place, because they would never have gone there if you'd said,
"It's not worth it.
I'm going to take you to a horrible place you never want to go, and you paid money to go there."
Yeah.
And you will feel shaken, and you will take this story home. Can I tell you a brief little story?
Yeah, sure.
It's something I open a lot of public events with. I went to a big benefit dinner once, and I was seated at a table next to a big, loud, funny guy. He was an oncologist, and he was telling this story about how he'd just flown into Portland, and as they were making the approach for their landing, he was drinking a glass of red wine, and the woman sitting next to him had been chatting to him the entire flight, just running her mouth, and she was talking about how much she wanted a glass of red wine, and she used to really love wine, and she really considered herself an expert on wine. She loved it. She wanted nothing more at this moment than a glass of red wine. But about 6-9 months previous, wine had started to really burn her throat. And so every time she drank wine, she got this fantastic burning in her throat. And it wasn't just wine. It was beer, anything alcoholic. And so she decided, she said, that God had decided that she shouldn't drink anymore. So she had quit drinking. But boy, she would love to have a glass of wine. And this guy, the oncologist, he's telling this story. And he goes, ma'am, and he finishes his wine. And he says, I'm an oncologist. And you have just described what we call a canary indicator. And that's a very early onset symptom of cancer. And what you described is the very early canary indicator of Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Damn.
That when you drink alcohol, it burns your throat very badly. And since this started 9 months to a year ago, when you land, you need to call your lawyer. Don't call your doctor. Call your lawyer first, because you need to have a will in place.
Fuck.
You're probably going to be dead within a month. And then he waits a beat. We're all sitting at this table. And he goes, and she was a lot less chatty after that. And he gives her his card. And he says, have your primary care call me. And he says, a couple days later, primary care calls this guy and says, yeah, you're right. Congratulations. She's going to be dead by the end of summer. But you could have been a little less of a son of a bitch the way you told her. And I say, okay, tonight there's a really good chance I'm going to say something that really shocks and offends you. And for the rest of your life, the first time you drink at a party on a Friday night, you're going to worry about that first drink, whether you have cancer or not. But the second drink is going to be better than any second drink you've ever had. Because your first drink, you'll always wonder, is this going to burn? Is this going to burn my throat? Do I have cancer today? And when it doesn't burn your throat...
Let's go to town.
Yes, exactly. You're going to feel a kind of freedom that you never felt before. And a kind of, you know, escape from death you never felt before. And I think in a way, so often when you present people with a story that starts very funny and moves through tragedy and leaves them shocked in that way, you are kind of giving them a death and a resurrection.
Wow, because you're going to always be thinking about it once you hear that thing, or at least for a while. Damn.
It's funny because that...
And I'd be like, cool, it's not you. Don't worry about it. It's rare.
The canary indicator story became so popular that a kid came up to me at Comic-Con, this great big pink, healthy 20-something guy.
Yeah.
And he says, you know what comes before... the alcohol is several weeks before that canary indicator. There's an even earlier indicator. And that's if you become suddenly very flushed and itchy, your skin turns very red and becomes very itchy, like you've overdosed on niacin. That is a very even earlier indicator of Hodgkin's. And he had had that.
Damn.
And he had been diagnosed very early and had fully recovered from it. But, so now people can worry about itchy red skin.
My friend Duncan, who he used to end every comedy set in Los Angeles with a low, low level we were at. But he was like, oh, by the way, guys, just so you know, there's going to be a major earthquake this week in Los Angeles. And then he would get off. And once every year and a half, he was right. And people were like, what? How the fuck did he know? How the fuck did that one comic know? Sorry, just remember that. Are you still doing any of these pranks today?
No, you know, I kind of try to limit it to the work that I do. Most of my cacophony people,
mm-hmm.
Cacophony has been boiled down to a giant coffee table book. Smithsonian has had an exhibit on cacophony.
Yeah.
And once you're in the Smithsonian Institute, you're kind of...
It's tough to keep going.
Go on.
Yeah.
And it's like you said, you know, our connectivity has kind of destroyed this kind of underground. It makes it harder to keep a secret that way.
Yeah. Of just like, we were all there and that's it. Nobody really remembers the time pre-cell phones when if you're just out, you're out. You're not reaching anybody. If you're late, like here, getting the drawbridges up, it's like, I have no way to tell you, you know, 15 years ago, they're like, I'm going to be 10 minutes late. you'll just be waiting there. I'm like, what the fuck? It's just such a different time. And it was such a free time, too.
Yeah.
You would go out biking and your mom would be like, be home by supper. And then you could be anywhere in the world until supper. And she would have no clue. Could be abducted in two states away. And she'd be like, yeah, she'll be home in 5 minutes. Oh, sorry, I love this stuff. What was I going to tell you? Oh, fuck, I forgot that. Do you know Adbusters at all?
Yeah, you know, Adbusters, the writer, Doug Copeland, he wrote for Adbusters. He's one of the main contributors. He wrote Generation X, and he's a good friend of mine. But yeah, I remember Adbusters from the very beginning.
Really?
Yeah.
They seem to be doing that same sort of, like, I guess, cultural jamming, or at least commenting on it.
Are they still around?
Mm-hmm. It's my favorite magazine. I'm interviewing the Callie Lassen on Monday, the editor.
Up in Vancouver?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Because they were the first way that I was aware of memes. I was aware of all these different memes and trademarks and logos and things that just, you know, eat up our lives.
Yeah. Yeah, they really do. They're starting now like a meme war. They're like, the only way to change the governments and the systems is through memes. That's the way anybody gets any information.
And there was also a movement a long time ago where people were trying to remove the memes from their lives. So they took all the labels off their packaging, and they took the labels off their clothes, and they tried not to have any kind of visible memes in their lives.
Yeah. Somebody said once a long time ago, it's like, if you don't believe advertising works, then why are people brand loyal to cigarettes when it's all from the same fields? And like, it's just because the dolling up of it
and that
the packaging.
The shocking little experiment when people still know the Big Mac song, even though the Big Mac song is not a
special song. Yeah, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions, and sesame bun. What the fuck? That's some fucking 9 years old.
It hasn't been advertised. It hasn't been broadcast in the mainstream media since like 1972.
Jeez.
And it's still so part of our awareness.
Yeah. That's the most dangerous.
Well, but on the other hand, whenever I hear somebody from Barack Obama to anybody say, the first rule of blank is you don't talk about blank.
Yeah.
Part of me just like,
yeah. Do you feel pride on that? You must, right?
You got, yeah, when you, yeah, it's wonderful to feel like you've kind of put something in the culture and.
It's there forever now, yeah. And that people don't even know where it's from a lot of times.
Which is wonderful, even better, you know, because people don't, they see the Nike ad, or they see all of these things about Burning Man, and they don't really realize that just a handful of people put this together. And there were people who had no resources, who had no money. They were just barista kind of people.
Who were just getting together to get out of this.
Right, to kind of get rid of their boredom and to do something fun.
When you saw, sidetrack, sorry, but when you saw Fight Club, the movie, how'd you feel about it? As I'm sure they changed it.
You know, for me, it just occurred as like an old family movie, because my friends had done all those things and my friends had said most of those things. So in a way, it was like seeing a scrapbook and watching it with my friends. They were all so thrilled because some weird, goofy thing they'd said at a party when they were drunk was now being said by Brad Pitt. And they were so tickled to see how many portions of their lives had been, somebody had actually been listening and had documented them and had preserved them in a way.
Oh, interesting. And as the writer, were you like, you guys did a good job, or were you like,
No, I wanted to see them do a better job. You know, what's the point of doing it again if you're not going to do it better? I wanted, in a way, for them to eclipse the thing. You know, Rosemary's Baby, such a great adaptation that people forget it was a book, and it was a huge book. The Graduate was a book, but nobody realizes that.
Because it was so good as a film.
Exactly.
Oh, interesting. That's how I feel about cover songs. I'm like, don't do it the same way. Change it up. Like, reimagine it.
Yeah, like Madonna did with American Pie.
Uh-huh. Or like Tori Amos' Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you don't even know what it is halfway
so
through.
So much better, yeah.
Yeah. And then you hear that Weezer version of Toto's Africa, and I'm like, I can't tell which version this is. All you guys did was just steal every note they wrote and played, and just doing it exactly the same. Yeah. How are you still writing like all the time? What's your daily process?
You know, I only write when I've got an idea and I've got so many ideas that I'm terrified of losing them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll start to sort of brain map and put them down in a list. And then if there's a very rainy day when I have no other choice or if I'm stuck somewhere, like in an airport or a hotel room, then I'll actually keyboard them and start to move them around and see what fits next to what and where they're sterile, where there are holes, where I need to kind of create more of a bridge.
You just let yourself like toss them around your brain until then?
And I take the idea around to all my friends and I say, so I'm working on this story about blank. I tell them the premise and I get their take on it. First of all, I see if they engage with it, if they react to it, if they laugh or if they're kind of shocked.
Mm-hmm.
And that's then a good if it resonates right with something in their life, if they've got a similar version, oh yeah, that happened to me. And they'll tell a similar version that will inform my version and give it a greater, sort of a more broader basis. So, and they'll test it for whether or not it's entertaining, whether people instantly engage with it, but they'll also develop it by giving their experience related to that topic.
Oh, interesting. And then you can, not steal, but, you know,
hey, you
incorporate,
know,
whatever the word.
Exactly, harvest.
Harvest, there harvest. You go. Yeah, harvest doesn't hurt the trees. When they say, when they talk about, I'm sorry, I keep jumping in and out of this.
And it's not like they don't know I'm a writer. It's like they know that yeah. somebody's going to write this down.
There was this MMA fighter, George St. Pierre, was like one of the greats, and he was talking to Rogan, and Rogan was talking about this back kick he used to do a long, long time ago, and he was like, show me. And then, dude, there was this video they made of it. It was just Rogan talking about me as a 20-year-old doing this thing, and his next fight, he used it. It was crazy. And it was like, yeah, it's not stealing. It's just like, interesting. I like that. I mean, most of writing anyway, or stand-up that way, is like trying to get real dialogue and then misappropriating it into a place for laughs. You know? That's what I do now with religion. I just use it against them.
Well, and so often, if you find the germ of something in your own life and you repeat it to other people at a party, and then people are sort of competitive, and they will attempt to dominate by coming up with a better version of the same thing from their life. Well, this happened to me. Something like that happened, but it was even more intense.
Mm-hmm.
And in their competitiveness, they're just kind of serving you great dollops of good stuff.
Oh, wow. You ever get a story that you know is not going to one-up this guy, but you want to say it? So you're like, hey, stop before you say yours, because yours sounds great. Can I say my lesser one first? Because I can't say mine after you've already said this crazy one where everybody died.
You know, no. Usually no. I just plant the lamest version,
mm-hmm.
because I don't want to present something so strong that it shuts down conversation.
Oh, good point.
Because I think that the good stuff generates, like we talked about, generates people talking about it in order to assimilate it, to adjust to it.
Just a germ, and they'd be like, oh, I could beat that.
Yeah,
exactly. Dude, I started a storytelling show that ended up being on Comedy Central for a while by telling a mushroom story to my friend at a Thanksgiving party, then him jumping on one at Coachella on mushrooms and somebody else saying one. And then I'm like, dude, we all have these stories. Let's do a show.
You know, for years I've been going around with job hazing stories. When I first, after college, the only job I could get was building trucks on an assembly line.
Mm-hmm.
And my first day, my foreman sent me to get a squeegee sharpener from some other foreman. And everybody cursed me out. Sent me to another workstation to get the squeegee sharpener. And I was just abused all day long and sent all over this gigantic plant. But by the end of the day, I had learned every workstation I might be assigned to, I had met every foreman, and I'd learned there's no such thing as a squeegee sharpener. So, for perpetuity, anytime somebody came up to me and said, we need your squeegee sharpener, I knew it was their first day. See, it's cute, it's lame, but it generates the most appalling stories. What people do to each other as part of job career hazing is over the top. What surgeons do to each other is just brutal.
Wow, really? What do they do?
There was a, and forgive me, I might have told this to Joe Rogan. I hate to repeat myself.
Yeah, I know the feeling. But
a pediatric surgeon was telling me that when he was in residency, he'd been awake for 36 hours and eaten nothing but stuff out of vending machines. And he'd lay down on a gurney to try to sleep for a couple minutes and suddenly heard this announcement, you know, his name to room such and such stat, you know, code blue. He races through this hospital in the middle of the night. He goes to this area of the hospital he's never been to. He thought this part of the hospital was shut down because he's never been aware of anybody being assigned to these rooms. Gets off the elevator. The moment the doors open in the elevator, he hears screaming, just this screaming. Charges down the hallway to a door, a room. The room is lit kind of nightmarishly. And it's partitioned with cloth curtains in an unusual way. But he doesn't notice any of that because there's a naked woman in bed and she is covered in blood. And she is screaming. And she's screaming, "You killed my baby. You fucker, you killed my baby." And something hits him in the chest. And he instinctively, he just grabs it. He holds it. And he looks down and it's a dead baby. And the woman is screaming and screaming, and he's holding this dead baby covered in blood.
What?
And the room is lit so strangely, and it's curtained, it's partitioned so weirdly, because every surgeon and every nurse on duty is hiding in that room. And they all want to see this done to you because it was done to them.
What whose baby was
it? And the naked woman in bed is a nurse.
Is it?
And the baby is such a baby because it's one of those resuscitation babies. So it's a hyper-realistic doll.
Oh.
So it's weighted and it's jointed and it feels exactly like...
covered in blood and like, oh.
A Jesus. Baby.
I'm like, how do you get the baby?
And the blood is real blood, but it's the outdated blood that was being...
that they're not using anymore? What the fuck?
And he says, you never get over that. But you know that, you know, in a few more years, you're going to be hiding in that room watching this done to resident surgeon.
Oh, yeah.
So, and that's not even one of the worst ones, but they just...
And then they all just love it and come out laughing, and you're like, exactly. What? It, those moments, too, that 30 seconds of, like, it's almost like coming out of a dream where you're like, wait, was that real?
Well, you did have to adjust your entire frame of reality.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then you're like, wait, why is everyone laughing? There's a baby. Oh, wait. Oh, they're not... Oh, there's no baby. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, those moments are great. We used to this thing in Yeshiva where you would just tell somebody to go up. There were two guys who were in on it. Avi Rothman, I think, and somebody else. And it was just ask him how far his father can kick a football. Why?
What
ask him how far his father can kick a football. Okay. And you go up to him and you ask him that. Oh, okay. How far? And they'd be like, what? Just get the fuck away from me. He's like, what? Just shut the fuck up, dude. And then he would play it so real. And then they'd come back and be like, what was that? And you're like, what was what? And like, I asked him how far his father can kick a football. And he just kind of like got weird. Like, you asked him? That was a joke. His dad lost his leg like a year ago. Are you kidding me? And they just feel so bad. And they didn't know how to correct it. They're like, hey, I didn't know. And like, it was just great. But that guy knew no matter who comes up to him, he's going to have to like get into character at the drop of a hat, you know, and just go and just get upset.
And it creates an in-group, people who know about the joke,
mm-hmm.
and people who have to suffer the joke to be part of that in-group.
Yeah, and because then if you're hanging out with Avi and somebody goes up to him and asks, you're like, oh, here it is. Like, you have to try to play it real too and kind of look away.
I tell that story, a guy in Toronto, he worked in a brick factory, and he said his first day they tell you to get a bucket full of steam. And he's this young guy, and they show him how to hold a metal bucket upside down over this steam tap and then run with it really fast to hold the steam trapped in this upside-down bucket that is burning your hands. And so he says every day after that, if you see some idiot running around the brick plant with an upside-down bucket and burnt hands, you know it's his first day.
It's so great. I love those things, and they're just ongoing.
And they're really important,
mm-hmm.
you know, and... they're kind of poo-pooed now, so they're even more secret than ever. But they're really important for kind of bonding people, for giving people a common experience of kind of being fooled, being, you know, the bottom man on the totem pole. And they're not, I don't think they're nearly as cruel or mean-spirited. They're a kind of...
Why are they poo-pooed?
Well, now they're seen as harassment or bullying. So I think if they're done now, they're done much more secretively.
Yeah. The weird thing, though, it's not to a group. When it's to a group, it's like, this is a problem. When it's just to anyone new.
Right, which still qualifies in a lot of people's minds as bullying instead of a kind of rite of passage.
Yeah.
And I think they're more...
Like, why does it get a negative connotation? Rite of passage. Yeah. All right, so it's bullying. Why is that a problem? I've been bullied. It's okay. My friend has a joke about bullying. He goes, you think I was never bullied? He was like pro-bullying. He goes, I have red hair. You think this got through in high school with no issues? Did you... Yeah. Yeah, they really are great. And they kind of bring us together, too.
Exactly. They give us at least one common experience.
And now you're in.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you have a problem? You got to go soon.
I've got to be aware of an hour because I was supposed to be someplace just after 10. Oh, my God. And it's 11. Okay.
Should we wrap it up? Okay. Let me ask you just one or two more questions. So the way Fight Club was, the way I'm saying it, and the what you've taken from Cacophony Society to put in there, this dark, even as a film too. I read Choke, but I never read Fight Club. But with the ending, kind of like Inglourious Basterds, where you're just like reexamining the reality of the world. New York doesn't blow up. They never killed Hitler. You know, how were you able to keep this lame job you have without saying, all right, I'll make you a typical fucking book? You know what I mean? This, like, not poverty, but like struggling, boring life, and say, no, I'm not going to give in on these notes. I'm going to do a darker and darker book.
Because it wasn't about writing a book. It was about going to a party every week. The man that taught me writing said, okay, you've got to take your reward right up front. There's no guarantee that you're going to ever get a publisher or a contract or your book is going to make money. There's no guarantee of anything beyond the actual writing of the thing. But every week, you can deal with a personal problem that you can't resolve, but you can write about it within a metaphor, and you can exhaust your emotional reaction to it. And you can do that kind of really effective processing. And once you exhaust your reaction to a situation that you can't otherwise resolve, the situation just vanishes. If you quit being frightened about it or worried about it or whatever about it, angry about it, then it just disappears because it's your reaction that kind of keeps it in place.
Angry about what? Notes?
Well, Fight Club was a big dump story. I've been dumped by the love of my life. So I wrote Fight Club. And Fight Club kept me so distracted, allowed time to pass. It allowed me to exhaust all my feelings in this gigantic metaphor. And more importantly, once a week, Thursday nights, I got to go to Tom's house and hear everybody's stories and tell my story and then drink wine afterwards and talk about movies.
Tom, who was his last name?
Tom Spanbauer.
That's whose class you're teaching now.
Exactly. And so Tom's theory was, you know, you write about this very dangerous, upsetting thing, you exhaust it, and that in and of itself is the only reward that you're guaranteed. And that will keep you coming back to writing on the project.
The doing it.
Right. The doing is its own reward.
Do you know about the dogs, how they teach them, like show dogs? The Frisbee dogs, you know, the crazy ones. They're always wearing bandanas and jumping off people. But at first, it's like, catch a Frisbee, get a treat. And then I don't know how they tweak it, but the Frisbee is the treat.
It's funny because I had a dog that never had to have the treat. She just loved to
catch the Frisbee. Just went for Frisbee.
It just had to be catch that moving thing.
Yeah.
Kill that moving thing.
Yeah. And it's like, it's almost like if you're a mover, it's like, but you get off on moving. No. People, so they're like, let me move again, you know. That's great though, where you're just like, I'm doing it for the sake of doing it,
and it brings me together once a week with a bunch of people who don't know how to come together. Tom always said writers write because they were not invited to a party. And so we got to form our own party, kind of in a way that Cacophony was a bunch of misfits that threw their own parties.
Wow, that's great. Okay, last question. When it says you may already be a member, we'll break that down for me.
Boy, I think it was kind of that slogan in Cacophony, you may already be a member, was this kind of a bait that if you don't fit in, if you don't find regular life very fulfilling, if you're just kind of faking the enjoyment you get from your friends from what you do, what everybody does. If you're just kind of, you know, doing it because advertising says this is what you should do, then Cacophony is an alternative to all of that.
And you're already there. You're already one of us, sort of thing.
Exactly, and you might as well just, you know, give it up and come here.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Chuck.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you being here, man.
You too. Thanks.
The Portland streets ain't nothing nice. Get caught up, another nigga getting smoked tonight. Cause it's that Portland life, niggas. Yeah, cause it's that Portland life. The Portland streets ain't nothing nice. Get caught up, another nigga getting smoked tonight. Cause it's that Portland life, niggas. Yeah, cause it's that Portland life.
Okay, that was the episode. I'm fucking gone. I don't think we even need a wrap up, really. Why do we even need a wrap up? Just an excuse to get another song in? I can't be right. I do like what he said. I wish I had my notebook, but I'm too drunk. I gotta pack. I gotta fucking pack. Fuck. I got an hour 45. I gotta shower. Shit. I'm fucked. I mean, I should have packed 2 days ago. All right, that's it. I got to go. Thank you, Chuck Palahniuk. You're fucking so smart and so fucking cool. I'm glad I got to meet you. That was rad. The guy writes a book every 9 months to a year. He's living his life as a creatively free individual, one of not that many in the world. If you want to support him, buy Choke right now and read it. It was fucking great. Adrian's reading it. Mike Vecchione is about to read it. I've been suggesting it just because of this podcast, because I remember Chuck and I was like, oh, I've read that book. And I'd buy that book. If you want to buy a book, I'm going to look it up right now on Amazon. Tales of the Coffee Set. Oh, also BlueChew.com, promo code Ari. But Amazon.com, yeah. Tales of the Coffee Set. Phony. Okay. Society. Okay, you're not going to do it just for Cacophony. I get you. I get you, Amazon. You do what you want. I get it. Tales of the Cacophony Society. Tales of San Francisco Cacophony Society. It's out July 1st, 2019. It's been out of, okay, paperback, $20.49. If you want to read more about these people and what they fucking did, go to Amazon.com right now and read about it. If you want to read a good book, Chuck Palahniuk, Choke. I gotta read more of his books. But yeah, I actually want to read this book, Tales of the Coffee. So I'm gonna order it right now, actually. That's it, you guys. July 31st, Indianapolis. Get tickets. August 4th, Turner Hall in Milwaukee. Get tickets. AriShaffir.com. I got nothing else to add. These guys made me jealous. Hearing about these stories, I will tell you this. I called Duncan. I was like, we got to get the LA SOGC back together. It makes me want to do more fun pranks. There's a joy in it. Like he said, the nod. There's a joy in fucking with people's mind. Just slightly that I want to get back to. Hopefully I can this month. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for tuning in. For Chuck Palahniuk, I'm Ari Shaffir, saying so long for Ari Shaffir Skeptic Tank, episode 360, the Cacophony Society. Goodbye.
You shot yourself?
Yes, but it's okay. Marla, look at me. I'm really okay. Trust me. Everything's gonna be fine. Very strange timing.